Hey, 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 everybody. Welcome to Critical Q&A, sorry, for number 449. Let's make sure we're all good. Yep, looking good, sounding good. Everything's good. Excellent. There we go. Okay, let's switch over to our chat screen here so we can see all of the beautiful critics and commenters and everything here on the screen. Welcome to the show. Today is Live Stream Central. I know other folks are streaming right now. Thank you very much for joining me live for this. You know, you have, as Southwest Airlines likes to say, you have a lot of choices in your streaming content. And we want to thank you for choosing us. All right. So let's see here. Yeah, there we go. Okay, good. Yeah, I kind of after the sort of debacle on Friday with the show and everything, I was like, oh my God. So I unplugged and reset everything and got it all kind of and kind of just did the whole cleanup and let's get everything all sort of tuned back in, and it looked like it worked. And I got my in the process I bought myself some more desk real estate and organized things a little better, so I'm pretty happy right now about all of that. Absolutely, I just wouldn't be me if I wasn't doing dad jokes. Anyway, I hope you all, yeah, the Friday show was just kind of a kickback affair. We just talked about all kinds of stuff. Boy, it's been a wild week, hasn't it? Woo! Interesting things afoot in the ex-Scientology world these days. So let's go ahead and let's set up the Q&A chat. Yes. Sorry that I am, where's my little mousy thing? There it is. All right, let's get this party started. So please put your questions in this, under this comment, so I can answer them. Okay, start Q&A. Okay, so as we do each week, I am using the YouTube Q&A feature. So I am seeing a box here that has the questions that you put underneath the comment. Please put your questions under this comment so I can answer them. So if you start plugging those in, they'll start rolling to me, and then we will get to answering your show. The new camera angle was great on Friday. Thank you. That's the webcam that sits up here. I didn't think it was that great, but I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. It was definitely an instance of making it go right. It's like, okay, well, here we go. I don't know what we're going to do, but let's figure something out. And we did. And we did a show anyway. And I was really happy that we did. Anyway, OBG Foster, yeah, trying to unsee a few things. I am sure that is true. All right, here's a great question to get us started today, and it's right on the line of what I'd like to talk about today anyway. So let's do this. Let me throw this up on the screen. Can you undo influence? Yeah, of course you can. Absolutely. By this, I'm going to answer the question of, you know, what do we do with the lingering after effects and consequences of undue influence? When somebody has too much influence and it ends up becoming a negative situation, a negative impact on your life, where the undue influence is generally defined as a premeditated, purposeful act or activity or actions on the part of a person, predator, let's say, a person who doesn't necessarily have your best interests at heart, that's undue influence, right? When they're influencing you, they're putting pressure on you, they're coercing you, they're lying to you, or they're telling you the truth, but they're doing it in a way that the truth is being used, say, to blackmail or to coerce or to, you know, influence a person. Lots and lots of millions of different ways that you can do that. Can you undo it? Sure. Yes, you can. In terms of how we talk about it here, I guess we'll talk about the psychological impacts of it, right? And it's bad. I mean, it can really mess with your attachments. It can mess with your, in other words, your relationships. And it can mess with your sense of reality. It can mess with your sense of identity or self to be negatively, unduly influenced by someone or some group. Can get you into a whole negative feedback loop where you're just doubting yourself all day, every day, constantly questioning your own intentions, your own purposes, your own meaning, that kind of thing. This is like it can really, really weigh on a person. It can get them wrapped up in this for hours and days and weeks. I've lived it, and certainly other people out there have as well. So can you undo it? Yeah, you can undo it lots and lots of different ways. This is the great thing. This is something that I really want to talk about and promote this sort of attitude or viewpoint more about recovery is that, you know, almost anything you do to come back from that, get over that, move on in your life from that, almost anything you can do is valid. Obviously, without hurting other people, right? But even talking it out, writing it out, journaling it out, videoing it out, you know, getting it out of you. There is something, and I don't yet totally even pretend to understand why this is. But there's this itch that we've got to scratch inside of us, I think. Certainly a lot of us, right? That when we are wronged, when we are hurt, when we have been abused or suffered at the hands of somebody else in an unjust, really screwed up, fucked up way, right? You need some kind of acknowledgement. You need somebody else to tell you, yeah, that's right. That was messed up. That was not okay. That was gross. That was whatever, you know, fill in the blank, right? But that acknowledgement, that somebody else gets it is so powerful. So I think a big part of undoing undue influence is getting some acknowledgement from somebody that you're not the crazy one, that you're not the one who has been, the bad actor in the situation, because good people, empathetic people, right? Empathic people, we do ourselves in over this stuff way before we will put it on somebody else or before we will, you know, we might try to, you know, voice our concern, but people don't listen. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to, they don't want to take the time. They don't want to believe it. They live in some kind of denial that that person, that bad actor, that predator could ever do something like, oh no, no way. That's just not possible. Yeah, it is. I mean, really anything is possible. And people can be very different from who you think they are. And getting acknowledgement for that, getting other people, you know, I think it's sort of the only thing I can relate it to getting this public sort of or private, I mean, just person, just somebody else getting you, right? Understanding you, and preferably more than one person. You know, there's power in getting a group of people or more than one person to get it, right? I think that's actually, I think I'm talking about right now, the thing that has motivated all of us on YouTube to get on YouTube in the first place, or at least most of us, right, is trying to find not just a voice for ourselves, but trying to get somebody else to hear our voice. And go, yeah, you know what? That was pretty fucked up, wasn't it? Yeah, I think it was. Man, that was really, you know, there's like some, that comes with that where we feel like, I think it has to do with social proof somehow. I think this is what I mean when I talk about how We are such social creatures. Our mind, I think, our emotional life, I think it extends beyond us, our body, right? Ourselves. And I don't mean in some spiritual, gooey, you know, airy-fairy way. I mean, if my wife's in a really bad mood, my mood is different. If I'm in a really bad mood, my wife's mood is different, right? People around you are affected by you. People around us affect us. And I think that this can be a negative or it can be a positive, depending on the situation. And I think that we try to get that agreement from other people because it makes us feel like we're not just acknowledged, but that somebody else, that it proves that we are right, that it proves that there's some truth to what we're saying because somebody else goes, yeah, that's right. And that's the social proof, right? Like I've talked about it in terms of how it can be used to influence people. It can be used to unduly influence people. Social proof can, right? But I think that, great point, Polar, right? This highlights the importance of listening to others, even if we think we may not agree with them. Yeah, I think that's kind of an ancillary of this. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that is a powerful way of undue influence or coercion, right? Or abuse. You know, kind of putting it out even more broadly, not just undue influence, but like all abuse. Like, why do we talk about it so much? Why do we put so much attention on it? Why are we drawn to it? It's not just that there's evil little demons inside of us. Oh, where's the conflict? Oh, drama, drama, drama. Oh, we're not just that. I've gotten really cynical sometimes about that. About people, you know? But it's not just that at all. It's not. I think that we're drawn to conflict also because there's something inside of us that sometimes, at least with some of us, maybe the more empathic people, right? I think there's something in us that's drawn to that because we want to do something about it. We want to help. We want to contribute to reducing that conflict. Like what? There's something. It's not just what's going on. What's going on? I just want to go watch it and eat the popcorn. There's that. But I think some of us are like, what can I go do about it? How can I help? How can I make this better? And I think that's what draws some people to this work, to not my channel necessarily, but Scientology, right? The Scientology, the X stuff. And I think that is an admirable thing. So I think that's part of what drives some of that group behavior too. I just wanted to comment on that, you know. Obviously, it's what people do with it, you know, that tells you what they're about. And I think that's important. That's important to acknowledge the good of that too. Not just be cynically, you know, all these rubberneckers. And oh man, I get really down on that sometimes. But I think that's the case. Thank you, Polar. I'm working on it, man. I'm working on it. Oh, we got a lot of questions coming in here, into the box here now. So let's go ahead and see what other trouble can I get into today? Answering some more questions about this stuff. It's funny, they come into the box here, but they take a little while to load into my other little box so I can throw them up on the screen. There's a little lag. I'm just kind of flowing with it as we go. You'll have to be patient with me. Beyond Jehovah's Witnesses asks me, are there many Scientologists with the Hubbard surname? No. I don't remember meeting anybody else in Scientology with the last name of Hubbard beyond the Hubbard family. Actually, now that you've asked me that question, I am curious, how common is the surname Hubbard. It is based on the 2000 U.S. Census. The surname Hubbard has been seen a slight decrease in popularity between 2000 and 2010. What was going on between the year 2000 and 2010 that would cause Hubbard to maybe not be such a popular name? The rank of Hubbard as a common surname slipped from 435 to 470, representing an 8% drop. So, okay. That might be kind of, that's a funny thing to see there. Okay, here we go. Other questions dumping in here now. Excellent. Anthony Spurgeon, let's go to it. Could we ever have a thriving atheist agnostic church where people can congregate once a week and read from science and philosophy? There's something like that in the UK, but I'm not aware of one here. Well, obviously, Anthony, you start talking about atheist churches to atheists and they're going to want to, you know, go find their guillotine and roll it out for you. For good reasons in many cases, as you know, Anthony, a lot of people in the atheist world are former believers who have bounced right out of that because they had their trauma epiphany and, you know, or moral outrage moment and decided that, yeah, no, I can't, this has been really, really bad for me. And it's just been a bunch of lies and I can't deal with it anymore. And they change their views. And so the last thing they want to do is go back to church. Right. But we joke about it in the atheist world. I mean, I have this secular hub here in Denver that I'm very fortunate to be part of and that I get to go and meet with fellow congregants. I'm saying that totally slash sarcasm, right? Because we're not a church. And we don't think about ourselves as a church, but we do fulfill the function of community. And that's, you know, emotional needs, right? Sociality. So I think you're going to find a great many atheist agnostic, quote unquote, churches. They're just not called that. They call them other things, like the secular hub or the free thinker society or this kind of thing. You know, they're all over the United States on Meetup and other places. You'll find groups of people gathered this way. So I'm going to say, Anthony, that the answer to your question is yes, we can. We're just not going to necessarily use that terminology. And people do exactly what you're describing at these groups. And I'm always happy to put in a plug for the secular hub here in Denver for anybody local here to go check it out. We got our own building and there are meetings there and meetups and events and all kinds of stuff. So anybody can set those things up and I hope they do. All right, let's carry on here. X-Science says the receptionist at Austin Org said she only volunteered about 4 days a week, no pay. She said the whole staff were volunteers, no pay. I asked, even the execs? Yes. Is that normal these days? Well, yes, it's always been normal, X-Cyan, but I believe she's giving you a little bit of spin in that she is giving you the technically correct answer for staff members at Scientology churches, which is that they sign a contract that states that they are religious volunteers. The language about this is not unspecific or vague. You know, it says exactly that. As I recall, that's the contract I signed. Maybe they've changed the wording since then, but I don't think so. And so that is what they are. And according to that, I think I even commented on this a couple of weeks ago. You know, there's no pay. It's pocket change. You get, you know, we're going to throw some money at you every week, depending on the income of the org, but don't expect any wage or employment level, you know, minimum standards or anything like that. You are a volunteer. This is how they get away with, you know, free labor for all of their churches, is they categorize all the staff. And by the way, all the Sea Org sign the same contract. The Sea Org does. Living, totally reliant upon Scientology Inc. for food, birthing, building, you know, safety, security, but they are categorized as religious volunteers who can be thrown to the curb at any time. And that's how the Sea Org gets away with what it gets away with, is they sign the same staff contracts. Every 5 years, they re-up, because the contract has a time limit. You check a box as to whether you're committing to a 2.5-year or a 5-year commitment. And so the Sea Org members re-up every 5 years. And OSA goes around with this little check, these little grids, and they make sure everybody's contracts are up to speed and legally binding would be the point. So that's, yeah. Okay. Will you watch the new season? Let me pull this up here. Beyond Jehovah's Witnesses, will you watch the new season of Scientology TV tomorrow? No. I have no interest or reason in watching Scientology TV. I haven't tuned in a very long time. I mean, it's there's a, let me share this in a much more broad sense. let me tell you how I do this. Because it's kind of like in the conspiracy world a little bit. I mean, I need to look up and read Scientology stuff from time to time to clarify or answer questions for you guys or pull up stuff I don't remember. And, oh, yeah, it said this and this and this, right? That kind of thing. When it comes to this, the specifics of some Scientology principle or something. But when it comes to Scientology promotional materials or television or what Scientology's doing in the world these days or something, I treat that the same way I treat Alex Jones or David Icke or, you know, QAnon stuff, right? Flynn, Mike Flynn, right? The old general NSA guy who got booted out of the White House on his ass for being influenced by foreign governments. These are conspiracy peddlers. These are sources of information that are useless. They're not just not giving you good data. They're actually feeding you bad data. They're feeding you information that if you try to think with that information, it's like a poison pill in your brain. And I don't want to go in the direction of, you know, the liberal mind virus and this kind of, you know, thing. But at the same time, you know, there are apt descriptions for certain behaviors, and it's a really apt description to call the things that Alex Jones and David Icke and Scientology and a lot of bad actors out there, Tucker Carlson. They have proven over time, over and over and over and over and over, you give them chance after chance after chance after chance. And I've probably gone down about 10 different rabbit holes with Alex Jones, right? David Icke, QAnon, right? You go down these rabbit holes, and you find that there is not just nothing there, that there is actually an agenda and an incentive to con you, to give you such false information that when you try to think with it, it messes with your head. It's impossible that these things can be true and align to other points of objective reality, right? Like, it just doesn't, these things just don't go together. In other words, right, another way to put this, it's propaganda. It's pure, unadulterated garbage information. It has no use to you whatsoever. There is nothing about it. Even trying to go in and extract little bits and pieces out of it, why? Why do that? Why spend the time? Why waste the time when you can go to other legitimate sources of information and get the straight facts without having to sift through 99% of horseshit. Total nonsense. That's how I look at Scientology propaganda. Right? At this point, there's nothing new happening, and there hasn't been in years. There's no new there for me to break down or analyze, right? We do it every week on Tony. I mean, when me and Tony go over stuff, we do break it down. But there hasn't been anything original that Scientology has done in decades. There's nothing new there. And, you know, and that's actually one of the reasons why after 10 years of doing this work, I feel very comfortable at the end of this month with going, you know what, I'm done making stuff about this. I've broken it all down for you guys, at least as much as I know how to do. So it can be entertaining, I suppose, you know, from that perspective, to go back over that stuff, Scientology TV. But at this point, it's just tiring to me. You know, it's just kind of like, oh, here's another meet a Scientologist. Here's another bullshit story about how they're helping in Taiwan or in Africa. Or here's the other photo op from, you know, some disaster site in Missouri or something, right? It's just more of the same crap. And there's just nothing new there. So that's kind of how I look at it now. I don't know. That's just kind of how I do. Yeah. Okay. OBG Foster, is there a common thing with people who have recently gotten out to go overboard with new freedom? Oh, hell yes. Absolutely. That absolutely is the case. And I'll tell you, the first thing that came to mind for me when you asked me that is actually, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, Romspringa, the Amish thing where they let kids go off for a year. I think it's 17 years old. And 17 or 18 or something, they let the 18, right? They let them go off into the world, 18, to experience it, and then for a year, right, and then come back. And routinely, those kids, those Amish releasees, will party, drugs, out, you know, all of it, right? They'll go down every rabbit hole of excess behavior. Not all of them, obviously, and not, you know, and I'm not even trying to paint with too broad a brush here, but it happens. It happens often enough that there are people who live around or external to Amish communities who actually take care to try to help those kids during that time so they don't go do that. That's how I know about this, as I've talked with these people. And they gave me a great deal of information years ago about how that all works and how they have to kind of, you know, help them through that time because they get money and they get work and they're very hard workers and they'll just go to town, right, with all this new freedom that they have. This was also rampant in the 1990s, I remember. We had continual ethics issues at PAC base with Sea Org cadet kids who had grown up, left, and gone out into LA and Hollywood because they didn't want to be a Sea Org member. They didn't sign the contract or they left. And they partied like it was 1999, right? They were just going to town and it was drugs and it was alcohol and it was partying and it was sex and it was everything. And it was the same kind of thing with that I'm talking about with the Amish people, but it was Sea Org kids. I remember this so clearly, right? And it was not just one or two incidents. This was a problem in PAC. It was a PR problem, right? An ethics problem, quote unquote, that they were trying to deal with. And so these kids were being, you know, there was a whole investigation launched by CMO at one point to find out where all these kids were going off the rails and what this was all about, right? And they weren't doing it, and they were doing it kind of one-on-one, and they were trying to find SPs or instigators because that's what Scientology does. And they were trying to control them, you know, wrangle them in and all that. And that's what I remember from that, just bits and pieces. I don't remember the whole thing because it's not like I was doing the investigation. I was just hearing bits and pieces about it. This was a CMO operation. But But that happened. That definitely happened in the Scientology world. When and so that's maybe youth people, right? Even older adult people who come out of cults will absolutely experience so much limitless freedom all of a sudden that they, you know, will go hog wild with it. Hopefully, you know, you always want people to please not go too far. Sometimes they do. You know, sometimes they do to very negative consequences. You know, you're at one end of a spectrum and you bounce over to the other one. That's worth commenting on, by the way. That's a pretty common thing for people, you know, regardless, cult or not, right? If you're caught up in something or you're being oppressed or repressed, you know, you're stopped. It's like it's an awful lot like the kid or a dog on your lap, and you put your arms around them. You know, they're sitting there all happy, little baby, little kid, you know, he's just, ah, it's all good. And you put your arms around him and they just get like, and they fight and fight and fight, right? And then you let go and they're like, and they fall down and hurt themselves or whatever, right? They don't like it. It's that one, you know, it's the extreme kind of thing. Probably not a great analogy, but it's just something that came to mind. Okay, yeah, make sure you get those questions in the comment, in the question box for me. Otherwise, I will not necessarily see them. And I can't throw them up on the screen either if you don't get them in there. Okay, let's carry on here. Good questions today. Keep them coming. Yes. Yes, this is a good question. Hypothetically, if I memorized a lot of the stuff that's online about Scientology, memos, LRH lectures, etc., and then went to an ideal org and talked about the info, would the staff become nervous? Yes. At this point in time, given what we know and how, you know, like what I think we were saying on Friday, how pulling the flippers they are, they're in turtle mode right now. Full on turtle mode. Scientology is terrified right now of the outside world. And there's a lot of reasons for that, as we talked about on Friday, right? The protests have definitely ramped things up for them, but this has been a situation that has been years in the making. Years. And so the staff now are super suspicious of anybody coming in. I mean, they're actively repelling people. And so if you go in there knowing things about Scientology and they haven't taught them to you yet and they don't know you and you're not somebody from another church or area who just moved into the area or something or is dropping by, you don't identify yourself that way, they're going to be nervous about you. Yes, they are, because they don't know what you know and they don't know what you're about to drop on them. And they know that there are people out there who are shouting no tea material at them and stuff like that. And they don't appreciate that, right? They don't like that. So they're all kinds of nervous about people coming in knowing Scientology, you know, at a level that they do or feel that they do. So, yeah, that'll definitely make them nervous. All right, XIN. At Austin Org, I asked for a free Way to Happiness booklet. She said they don't usually hand them out except at special volunteer events, but she gave me one because I was nice. Strange? Not at all. Not strange at all. That is typical behavior for staff. They want to give things to you because it's another point of social influence. If I give you something for free, you feel obligated to return back to me. Whether it's going to be time or money or information or whatever, there's an imbalance that you're going to feel the need to fill. That's why the Hare Krishnas gave out flowers and trinkets all the time. That's why Scientology gives stuff out that for free, right? Is because it sets that imbalance up that they want you to feel obligated to fulfill, right? Try to fill. I hope that makes sense, right? It's a point of influence, of social influence. So Not strange at all. It's strange when they don't give you anything. And, you know, if they just want you out of there, you know, out, that means they are not interested in you coming back or giving them any money. Right. So they liked you. You were nice. You know, you weren't a dick to them. So they want you to come back. So that's what that's about. And by the way, not one person in Scientology would ever be able to explain to you what I just said. They don't think about what they're doing the same way I will sometimes describe it to you. They're not that crafty. It's just a fact that if you give some, as organizationally, like this has been known about in advertising and marketing forever, right? Free samples, give people stuff. I mean, shit, drug use, you know, what's the word? God, what am I saying? Anyway, people who push drugs know this, right? Free samples. Oh, my mom is calling and I'm going to have to call her back later. Okay. Let's carry on here. Free samples. Pushers, that's the word I was trying to find. Drug pushers. They know all about this. Okay, Young Matador. Hey, Chris, the current rumors around David Miscavige attending the Paris org opening are confusing. Hoping you can settle the debate, would he likely journey all that way just for a pre-recorded speech? Oh, no. I believe the idea was that he wasn't there. And if he wasn't there, he wasn't there, period. It's not like he would go there and then not do the speech live in person. I mean, he would, of course. Unless there's something we don't know, what we do know is that Paris and France as a country is unfriendly toward Scientology. And I don't know if you guys know this. Let me share this with you. Because something happened years and years ago. Now, this was in Spain that this happened, not France. But in 1988, the president of the Church of Scientology, a man named Heber Jentsch at the time, was arrested in Spain along with 69 other members of Scientology. That happened. Jentsch was incarcerated in a Spanish jail for about 3 weeks. He was released and fled to the United States after Scientology paid a bail bond of approximately $1 million. 16 people, including Jentsch, were charged with illegal association, quote-unquote, and various other crimes, including tax fraud and endangering public health. The trial of the indictees began in February 2001, but Jentsch himself did not appear. The prosecution called for him to be given a 56-year prison sentence. However, the Madrid Provincial Court dismissed all but the conspiracy charge and eventually ruled that the prosecution had presented insufficient evidence to prove this charge as well, and in April 2002, the last charge was formally dropped. Now, I bring all that up, probably for obvious reasons. Right? You think David Miscavige is going to go anywhere where that possibility of happening to him is going to occur, right? No way. Absolutely not. And Miscavige, if all of us have pretty short memories of Scientology history, Miscavige doesn't, right? He remembers. And it was the emergency flap of the universe when Heber was jailed. We were, what? Yeah, I was just a new staff member in 1988. It was like, what? He's what? Like, we couldn't believe it. So France is a country that is definitively, notoriously anti-cult. They hate cults in France. They call them sects, S-E-C-T-S, right? And they are serious about it. They are not messing around in France about prosecuting Scientology or prosecuting other sects. And Scientology has been found guilty of fraud in France recently. So this is the exact opposite of what you would call a safe space for David Miscavige. And I personally, that's my answer as to why he didn't go there. I could be completely wrong, but that's my answer for why he didn't go. So, you know, hope that helps deconfuse the situation. Because it also matches up with why he wouldn't have gone to Germany for the other ideal org opening, or Russia for the other ideal org opening that he missed. There were three of them, I think, that Tony said he's missed. And it just so happens he missed them in countries where, had he been there and the authorities knew he was there, there was a very good chance that he could have been detained. So he ain't going for that. That's a guess on my part. It's not like I'm in touch with Russian or German officials or something, but that's what I understand it to be. All right, beyond Jehovah's Witnesses, does the Sea Org in the UK live at St. Hill? Do they live better compared to the LA Sea Org? They don't. They live on a Sea Org property that I believe they are bused to and from, that is not on the St. Hill property. I believe they have some apartment complexes or something that they have purchased that the Sea Org live at. That's my understanding of that situation there. They certainly do not live at St. Hill. The St. Hill Manor is a museum piece, and the castle is a service delivery facility. So nobody's living there. And I don't think the living quarters for the Sea Org are there on the property. There's probably people there 24/7, mind you. Security guards, that kind of thing, you know, people around. But I believe they get bused somewhere. This is an interesting question. 2 days after my visit to Austin Org, I saw the eclipse at the Capitol building. Two guys came by handing out Scientology flyers. I asked if one was OT. I got a weird look, and he said no. Why didn't he stay and talk? Because you know too much, ex-Scion. Because you freaked them out, right? Again, they're in turtle mode right now. Even when they're out passing stuff out, I'm telling you, I'm referring more to, I hope I'm being clear that I'm referring more to a mental state than I am to the physicality of it. Like, their doors are still open. You can still walk into a Church of Scientology, sign up for services, and they'll sign you up, and you can start. But they are freaked out. And when you know stuff that you're not supposed to know, you startle them. OT, how do you know about that? What, you're just some rando on the street. How would you know about OT? Right? You know, you're probably one of the bad people because you know. All right, let's see what else we got here. Beyond Jehovah's Witnesses, is the antisocial personality people who aren't Scientologists, or can members become thus as well? Okay, so what's this now? Is the antisocial personality people, members become thus as well? Anybody, in the eyes of a Scientologist, anybody can be an antisocial personality or a suppressive person. Anybody can be. Scientology, as we've gone over in some detail, only labels and declares people suppressive who have been Scientologists, but they think about people as SPs all the time who are never been or are not in Scientology. That label can get thrown around and applied to anybody. And I say suppressive because antisocial personality and SP are the same thing. So, you know, yeah. Ex-Scion, I would have liked to have talked to one of the staff at Austin Org one-on-one. Do you think that street epistemology would be worthwhile on a staff member at LA Org, maybe if I paid for dinner? Well, good luck getting them to go to dinner with you. They'll consider it an external influence. But street epistemology would be an absolutely amazing thing to use on a staff member. It would be incredibly useful and productive to do that. Yeah, Absolutely. Nobody talks to staff members like that, right? Nobody actually sits and really discusses their beliefs with them in a back and forth. Tell me why you feel this is true. Challenge it. Let's break it down. Let's look at this. You know, on a scale of 0 to 10, how certain are you that this is true? Okay, good. What informs that belief? Was there anything that could possibly poke a hole in this belief? Is there anything at all that you could be that you could learn that would in any way change this belief? How do you feel about that? If the answer is no, right, then how do you feel about that? Does that make sense to you? Does that sound like critical thinking? You know, asking a lot of questions of the person in a challenging but not accusative or antagonistic way is the whole point of street epistemology, right? It's the whole methodology of it. And it works when it's used right. It gets people thinking, in other words. That's what it's for. It's not to deconvert somebody necessarily. You can push it in that direction if you want, but that's an agenda-driven conversation. And the best use of street epistemology is to increase understanding between people and get people to think harder about their own beliefs and ideas and why they think the way that they think. The purpose of it is not to strip people of their ideas and beliefs. That may happen if a person has dumbass beliefs or ideas that they have no good reason to believe in. But understand there are people of faith who have incredibly well-reasoned beliefs. They have very good, solid reasons for believing what they believe. Not necessarily based in truth, but they are still good, solid reasons, and they can talk about those reasons, and you can break those reasons down with somebody. And by people of faith, I include Scientologists. There are also people of faith who have no understanding of their faith at all. They grew up with it, it was pounded into their head, and they believe it because they were told to believe it. And if you challenge them and have a decent conversation with them about those beliefs, that can unplug some of those unfounded ideas in their head. And they go, huh, I really don't understand. I really don't know why I believe that or think that. It really doesn't make a lot of sense that I would believe that so fervently just because my mom told me, right? Or whatever, you know, however you break it down for the person. But it can be really useful that way. And so, yeah, street epistemology would be a top of the list for me as far as how you would engage with a staff member. The challenge would be keeping them in the conversation, because the second that a cult member starts feeling cognitive dissonance is when they start getting pissed off or upset, because they don't want to have that feeling. They don't want their beliefs disturbed. And they're there to convince you, see, right? So when they start feeling like they're the ones who are on shaky ground, they get upset and they might disengage right then and there, right? And you've done your job, right? You created some challenging thinking for them. So even if they disengage and don't go and don't stay with you, you know, or resolve it or amicably, you know, leave the conversation or whatever, you've probably still done something good for this person by challenging and getting them to think about what they're saying and what they're thinking. That's my take on it, at least. For sure, right? Okay. Let's carry on here. What is a good way to learn street epistemology? Wow, what a great question. I wish Anthony Magnabosco was here, because he has actually, I should get him back on the podcast. We need to talk about this again. Street epistemology can be learned through a series of modules of online learning for free. You don't have to pay a dime for this. You can go to, I think it is, let me look it up here. I haven't referred anybody to this in a while. Epistemology. Is it streetepistemology.com? Let me check. It is streetepistemology.com. You go there and you are going to see it in action, ways to learn it, video examples of it. I feel like I should be getting paid for this, except it's all free. And we desperately want people to go look at these resources and check this stuff out. So that's how you would learn street epistemology, is go to the source and watch them do it. Stanley asks, I've been hearing bad reviews about BetterHelp counseling. What do you think, Chris? I think that I have not been using or promoting BetterHelp for many years now. I had them as a sponsor for a very short period of time on my channel when they were first emerging into the YouTube, you know, sponsorship kind of scene. And I had to stop because there were reports coming out of unlicensed therapists misrepresenting themselves, of some stellarly bad advice or direction being given to people. But more importantly, people not even getting help or advice or being connected with somebody who, you know, who absolutely was not a fit, and then being unable to find somebody else and that kind of thing. There were issues and problems, in other words. And maybe some of that, you know, was growing pains. I'm not on some crusade against BetterHelp, but I do want people to get good mental health therapy and treatment when they're reaching for it and paying for it. You know, I don't offer mental health counseling or therapy for people, right? So I'm not a resource for that. What I do is very different. So I want people who are going to go get therapy to get good therapy. And apparently there have been enough reports of problems with BetterHelp that I went, looks a little, you know, maybe not so great. The fact of the matter is, and I want to also, now that I've said that part, let me say this part too. We, as a society, as a collective or whatever, we desperately need more mental health accessibility. 4 out of 5 people have no access to mental health facilities or care of any kind. Won't even go pick up a book, much less go make an appointment with a psychologist and get therapy. 4 out of 5 of the people who need it can't get any of it. They're geographically challenged. They're just not near anybody that they can go see. They don't have the money or the resources or the time. They don't have the inclination because they are absolutely positive that nothing can be done about their situation, so they don't even try. That's a lot of people out there. A lot are absolutely convinced nothing can be done about it. That's a shame. I really, you know, my heart kind of cries for those people because of course something can be done about it. So we need better access to people who can help people with mental health care and treatment. We need that. It's a desperate need. I want services like BetterHelp, and there are other ones out there. I want services like that to succeed. I need them to succeed for what I do, for trying to help people and direct them to resources where they can get some help. I need stuff like that. So it's painful to me to watch it, you know, fall into the abyss or something, or see something that could be good turn into something bad. You know, that's really, really frustrating. Because if you're going to build a business, of course, you have to make money and you have to build a profit and you have to promote it and you have to put it out there, and mistakes will be made. 100% of the time, mistakes will be made. And worse, and let's be honest, if we're going to be really honest right now about this, and I'm here to be honest about stuff, you're dealing with a group of people, mentally challenged, mentally ill, people who have disorders and problems. You're dealing with a group of people who are sometimes going to target you when you didn't do anything wrong. That's trauma. That's what happens with it, is it can be triggered by things that are not abusive because it reminds, you know, of the abuse, right? The brain just goes, this looks exactly like what I did before. And I'm scarily close right now to talking about, you know, like re-stimulation in Scientology, and that's not what I'm talking about. The mechanisms of all of the Scientology stuff related to this are total horseshit. There's no reactive mind. There's no engrams. There's none of that crap. So I always feel a little leery going into this territory, but it's just the fact, right? Hubbard's full of shit, but trauma's real and triggers are real and people freak out. And they can make mistakes in their present environment, connecting it to their past environments and their past responses and issues and problems. And they can take stuff out on people in the here and now who did not deserve it. That happens. And it can happen with therapists and people who are trying to help them. That can happen, right? They can be wrongly targeted. And I'm not saying it's some big, broad situation. I'm not talking numbers here. I'm just talking about the fact that that can happen. And that is another variable, you could say, in the mix of trying to help those that population of people, right? I've experienced it. Absolutely, I have. And I don't mean in helping people. I mean in getting help. I mean, I've been triggered by people, right? Rah! You know, and attacked people and been vicious with people who didn't deserve it at all. In my personal life, right? I'm not talking about here on my channel. Over the years, right? You get set off, right? Something triggers you. And it's just, oh. So who's to say that a therapist can't trigger that and cause a problem and the person freaks out and, you know, then has nothing but bad things to say about the therapist and they'll even say they abused me and all of this when no such thing happened. I'm always losing the phrases here and I'm on mic. Danger of the field, you could say, right? It's an occupational hazard. There it is. It's an occupational hazard. So that's a thing. Okay. So that's what I want to say about all that. Xion, have you heard of a character named Alfred Hubbard and his involvement with MKUltra and the CIA regarding coercive control techniques using LSD? That sounds vaguely familiar to me. I don't remember the name Alfred Hubbard right now, but I certainly remember MKUltra messing around with people, LSD given to people without their knowledge or consent, etc. So, no, don't remember Alfred Hubbard off the top of my head. Maybe, yeah. Certainly no relation to L. Ron Hubbard, I'll say that. I mean, we know there's no connections there, at least not that I've ever heard of. That I would have remembered. Let's carry on here. Okay, let me just give the usual, I can't believe it's been an hour. How has it been an hour? How is that possible? Beyond Jehovah's Witnesses asks a very interesting question. Oh, and Laura Davis, get that. If that's for me, get that question in the comment box there. Beyond Jehovah's Witnesses, as far as you know, what did LRH's parents think of him forming his own religion? As far as I know, they thought that he was conning people. I'm not really sure. But I know they weren't happy about it. And that's literally all I know, right? Is there was a flavor from some things that I read from Russell Miller and some things that I've read online. I can remember two or three things I've read at total. I mean, there's really very little out there about Hubbard's parents and their relationship after Hubbard left home. But I never got the idea that they were okay with what he was doing or that they were even very well connected with it. But I know they knew what he was up to. I know they visited him in Arizona in 1952, I believe, or 53 maybe. It would have had to have been 53 in Arizona. That's when Nibs connected up with Hubbard, L. Ron Hubbard Jr., right around that time. So yeah, maybe 52, 53. Actually, anyway, I know that they were not super on board. That's all I really know. Young Matador, what do you think of Richard Dawkins' comment a few weeks ago that he considers himself culturally Christian? A lot of people both defending and criticizing his comments. Yeah, let me go ahead and jump into that argument. I think what Richard Dawkins was trying to acknowledge, and I didn't go deep on this one. I only saw a few quotes and headlines about this. Okay, so I'm just commenting here. It's incredibly controversial, an incredibly hot topic in different places of this country, the United States, as to whether we are a Christian nation or not, what that means. This country was founded on Christian principles and that sort of thing. I'm no religious studies scholar or history expert, and I'm not claiming to be. I have a general understanding of certain aspects of history. I have a very good understanding of Scientology's history, and I have a pretty good grasp of certain occult practices in history in regards to religion and stuff like that. But I'm not, I'm going to say all that to say, right, that I'm offering opinions on my part, not expert, like well-informed, you know, this is how it is kind of stuff. This is incredibly controversial stuff. And a lot of people from all ends of religious studies have wildly different opinions about this stuff, depending on their own personal religious beliefs. You'll find some religious studies scholars who will double and triple down on the fact that America was founded on Christian principles. It's a Christian nation, one nation under God. That's what it is. And we should be adopting Christianity as the national religion. At the other end of that spectrum, you have like Andrew Seidel, like lawyers and religious studies people who are like, yeah, screw that. There's a separation of church and state, and never shall these things be brought together. And that's what the founding fathers meant. That's what they said. And that's what they wrote about in their private and public papers. And we understand this very, very thoroughly. And these things need to be kept separate and apart from one another. What Dawkins is saying is that he believes that in that he, I know Dawkins is a very hardcore separation of church and state guy. But I think what he's trying to communicate there is that while we can acknowledge that the church should not formally be involved in governmental processes or legislation or decision making, and vice versa, the church should not be entering into the government, rather, should not be entering into church affairs and telling people how to worship, when to worship, who to worship. None of that should be happening from a government position. That's the whole separation of church and state thing. You can acknowledge all of that and still say there's so much Christianity in our culture. The cross, Jesus, the symbolism, turn the other cheek, the sayings, the writings, the phrases. It's all throughout our language. It's all throughout our morality. It's all throughout how we dress and how we think and how we make movies and how we talk about stuff. Jesus Christ, right? I mean, we don't say Muhammad, Buddha, right? It's Jesus Christ. It's pretty deep in us. This is the cultural aspect of Christianity embedded into our lives. 75% of Americans are Christian. They think with Christian principles. They use Christian language. They talk about things from a Christian perspective. So it's embedded in our culture, and I don't think it's controversial to say that. And I think Dawkins was trying to acknowledge that fact. I'm not really sure why. I don't know why that's a relevant point to make. It is a point. It's a piece of truth. I don't know if he's trying to meet it halfway or something, or how he's trying to use that. But that was my understanding of what he was talking about, pretty simply. And you know, I don't know. Okay, let's carry on for a little bit, and then I'm going to have to wrap up here. Anthony Spurgeon, what's your favorite ancient myth or legend? That's a great question. I remember being fascinated by the oldest story being what, Grendel and Beowulf, right? I remember that being really interesting to me when I first read about Beowulf. But my favorite myth or legend, honestly, I'm going to say Tolkien. And I'm going to use the Middle Earth and Tolkien because that's what Tolkien wrote it for. My understanding of the Lord of the Rings and the entire Middle Earth, Silmarillion, all the books, the entirety of the mythology goes well beyond the One Ring and Mordor and Sauron. There's a lot more to that mythology, including an afterlife and another place where people go, these sort of undying lands kind of concept, Valar, and the angels, you know, the ultimate, you know, the sort of God figure. I'm forgetting his name right now, Uwe or something. There's a lot of myth, including a fully written, fully put together creation story and all of it, right? It's all there. And I understand that Tolkien wrote this to give the United Kingdom, to give England or that country, his land, their own mythology. You know, the Vikings have their mythology, and Odin and Thor and Loki and all that whole pantheon of gods and that whole cultural mythology that comes out of that area. And Tolkien was kind of like, well, where's ours? You know, and he put together this whole thing. That's that somebody described Tolkien's work that way, and I was like, God damn, really, right? And I've read the Silmarillion, and I've read these, you know, I haven't read all of Tolkien's works, not by a long shot, but I've certainly read a lot. And I have always found it to be just absolutely awesome, right? Like if that, yeah, an English kind of mythology. That's right. That's exactly right. Oh, you've read them all. That's awesome. Yeah. I love this stuff. I mean, I love it. I can't say I'm as well versed in the lore as many people are. I can't speak Elvish. I don't read it. I'm not that nerdy on this stuff. I'm down that rabbit hole a bit further than I think a lot of people are. And I have found it to be like, if I had to choose a mythology that were true, I'd take that one. I think it's cool. I think the relationship of men and elves and dwarves and the creation story of them and the Valar and the land across the sea and all of that and the idea of all of that is amazing. I think it kind of sucks that men don't get to live, you know, that humans don't get to have the same sort of eternal existence that the elves have. Always been a little jealous about that, you know? Right? Tom Bombadil is Eru. Prove me wrong. You know, I think he's an aspect of that. I think that's true. That's always been my go-to explanation for Tom Bombadil is he's just sort of a physical representation of God living his best life in his creation. I've always imagined that's the answer to Tom Bombadil. Love this stuff. Anyway, so all right, so we've gone off on that track for a bit. Okay, Liz D asks me, did you say Sea Org members re-up every 5 years, even with the billion-year contract? Yes, I did. And the reason for that is because the staff contract is a legally binding agreement. It's for real. It's legally binding. It's a real contract that you're signing. And you are committing to 5 years of servitude to the Church of Scientology in exchange for free services and whatever else they're going to give you as a religious volunteer. And they need you to be legally bound as a religious volunteer in the Sea Org. Because the Sea Org billion year contract doesn't mean shit. It means nothing. You might as well put your signature on a piece of toilet paper. It's useless. The Sea Org contract doesn't mean shit in terms of any official anything. So that's why they have to go with the 5-year contracts for the Sea Org members to keep them legally in line, right? If they needed to. Oh God, right? Yeah, Galadriel is just fucking amazing. And don't even get me started on Rings of Power. I have nothing good to say. Really good production values. It's kind of what you're stuck with when you get these like mega productions that have invested millions and millions of dollars in art direction and production design, and it's just this beautiful piece of work, and then it's absolutely completely destroyed by the character arcs and the writing and the direction. You're just like, what am I watching right now? You know, that's how I felt about Rings of Power. Just the worst. Oh, God, it just makes me sick. Oh, I don't know. I have no idea, Debbie. I've always wondered what happened to the group of people who went to prison. Did they stay in Scientology? You're referring to that Spanish thing in 88. It was ancient history. I don't remember and don't know. I wonder if John would remember. I'll have to see if I can remember to ask him about that. John Atack. Maybe he knows. Okay. Elk of Antioch. Got some great questions coming in today. If World War III is breaking out, or if looking back, it has already begun on October 6th, how will Scientology feel about World War III? Christian Broadcast News has been all over Israel looking for prophecy. God, yeah, I know. There are a disturbing number of people out there who seem to be really giddy with anticipation about the apocalypse. It's a little scary, to be honest with you, because these are people who basically seek death. It's fucking really disturbing. I am really put out by that. You know, you want to believe in the rapture and Armageddon and all that. I don't care, you know, but it's pretty disturbing to be like, it's happening. It's happening. Oh, all the biblical prophecies are lining up. Ah, you get this glazed look, you know, it's just like this. Oh, I can't stand those people. Yeah, so there's a lot of that out there. There always has been. I mean, it's not like this is something new. These people have always existed out on the fringes. Your question is, how will Scientology feel about World War III? They're not going to be happy. Scientologists do not want war. They're not fanatics that way. They're not jihadists. They're not biblical prophecies. There's no end times writings in Scientology glorifying the end of the world. And there are in Christianity, and there are in Islam, right? And there isn't in Scientology. Nobody wants the end of the world in Scientology. They want the world to keep going. They want a world without war, insanity, or criminality. That's what they want. That's the message they're buying into in Scientology. And it's not a bad message. That's not the bad part about Scientology, is its goals, as stated by L. Ron Hubbard in the goals of Scientology, right? The aims of Scientology is the issue type, is the issue name. And Hubbard is crystal clear, right? A world without insanity, war, criminality, where honest beings have rights and honest men can rise to, you know, greater heights or something like that, I think is the exact quote. And obviously they just want to sell stuff, right? That's the wave that they're riding. But when you ask about Scientology, does Scientology, you know, how will Scientology feel about World War III? They're going to feel like shit about it because it's going to get in their way. They're not fighters that way. They would call themselves spiritual warriors, not war warriors, right? They hate war. They hate violence in that sense, in that way, the senseless killing of other people over land, territory, geography, belief. This is anathema to most Scientologists at a personal level. They're generally very good people when it comes to stuff like this. Now, that's my experience talking. And I have to stress now that that everything I just said is dated information. I don't know what Scientologists think these days after COVID and QAnon have hit as hard as they did, knowing how right-wing and frankly nuts some Scientologists can get with their conspiracy theories. There could well be a whole bunch of Scientologists at this point who are avidly looking forward to World War III because they think it's going to bring down, you know, the New World Order or some shit. So, you know, so that's kind of a thing. Don't know if that clarifies at all. Feel free to ask me more about that if you want to know anything more specific about that. Jew Martins, did you watch their documentary about Raelians? No, I haven't done that yet. I haven't watched any documentaries recently. I've been too damn busy with other stuff. It's been... yeah, it's been a crazy couple weeks. Old Bay asks me, have you seen Dr. Stephen Hassan's video about J.K. Rowling's descent into Holocaust denial and other conspiracy theories? I have not. I'm kind of avoiding that whole thing, to be honest with you. It's just not my circus, not my monkeys, not my thing. I support human rights for all. I support, you know, and I don't mean that in an insulting way. I just, it's a phrase, right? It's just not my business, not my thing. It's not my cause. It's not my hill to die on. It's not my battle to fight. I respect Steve Hassan's views and writings about cults and about cult dynamics and the Bite model and the work that he's done in intervention work. I respect him at a professional level on those things. The culture war stuff, is not stuff I get into avidly watching or doing stuff with. I'm busy enough with the stuff I do that I don't need to go get into that fight too. I have been clear from day one on my channel that I support human rights for individuals and people and stuff like that. And that's where I plant my flag. You know, I want people to get along. I want people to be who they want to be, live the life they want to live, and identify how they want to identify. It's not my damn business, right? Why would I care, right? What anybody else does in their life, in the bedroom, out of the bedroom, it's not my thing. To the degree that somebody is harming someone else, abusing someone else, lying or deceiving someone else, I have problems. That's where my moral foundations start getting, shaken, and where I start, my moral outrage starts ringing, right? That bell starts ringing is when I'm watching coercion, when I'm watching abuse, when I'm watching culty behavior of extremism. And I've seen plenty of extremism on all ends of the LGBT questions. And I've talked about that stuff often to my regret, because you just can't be in, you can't take a 100-foot view and go, look, there's culty stuff that goes on all ends of this, because humans are humans and that's what humans do, right? You're not going to be allowed to do that. You got to take sides, and I don't want to go there. I don't, you know, so that's what I can say about that. I have my own personal take on stuff, you know, that is my own personal take on stuff, but that's not important to what I'm trying to do with this channel and the help that I can provide to people on any end of any spectrum, you know. And if I've ever regretted anything, it's been that I've expressed opinions and views here on my channel over the years that have turned people off so hard that they refuse to get any of the help or advice or information that I have to offer. I hate that. It really bugs me. right? That, you know, because I've expressed a view that is even partially in some direction, people are so partisan on stuff that they just black and white you. And, okay, well, then you're just an evil person. I'm not an evil person. I know I'm not, right? But I'm wary around certain topics because they're so hot and so incendiary that if you slip up in the smallest way, you know, people will come after you. And I don't, that's not what I'm here doing what I'm doing. That's not what I'm doing any of this for, you know? So that's kind of the deal with that. All right, let's carry on. Man, 221. We're just kind of getting used to having longer Q&A shows, aren't we? You guys just keep plying me with questions, and I just kind of keep wanting to answer them. Oh, not in a long time. Here's a really interesting question. Lulu Baru. Okay, I think I get it now. Do they use the threat of his detainment? Here you're referring back to the question about David Miscavige. Do they use the threat of his detainment in France, Denmark, etc., inside the Church of Scientology as some sort of propaganda? The Heber Gentz detainment. They did, but it's ancient history now. That's why I had to pull up Wikipedia and tell you all about it, because it's from the 80s. Nobody remembers that shit. I mean, I remember it, right? John Atack remembers it, but a lot of people do not, right? They just don't keep tabs on this stuff. But it's, but David Miscavige sure does. But they don't, no, they would not ever say that David Miscavige didn't go to France and open up the Ideal Org because he was afraid of being detained. I'm pretty sure you can figure out why, right? It would make him look weak. It would make David Miscavige look like a coward. And more importantly, it would look like David Miscavige that there was some reason that France wants to detain David Miscavige. And we can't be forwarding any of that. That would be off policy. That would be forwarding enemy lines is the phrase they would use in Scientology. You don't do that. So no, they're not going to use that as a thing. They could, though. What they will do is they will spin it so that if it comes up, or if Miscavige were somehow cornered, or somebody were in the know or somehow cornered on this, they would spin it that it's France that's the bad guy. France is the problem. France has SPs in the government. France is unfriendly to Scientology because SPs have gotten to the French government, and we need those Ideal Orgs there to turn that tide and get rid of those SPs. That's about as much propaganda value as you would find there in Scientology on that. But I'd actually be surprised if it came up at all inside that world. Yeah, I know. I guess it's just the curse of us old timers, right? No one remembers the 80s, road to freedom here comments. No one remembers the 80s. That's why the youth of today, the teenagers, are reliving it. Big hair and all. That's right. Oh, you guys are nailing it. Okay, let's see if we can take a couple more here. I really am trying to go, but I'm so happy to answer your questions at the same time. Okay, Red Pill 3000, under what circumstance would you wear a sleeveless shirt if nobody else is in the room? How about a fanny pack? Not since the 80s. Also, which bands would be at your dream music festival? Where would said festival be held? Okay. If I could have my druthers, my dream music festival being like living or dead, right? We're going to bring back the dead on this one. Because Rush is at the top of that list. Absolutely, I would have Rush playing at my dream music festival. I would have the Police there, reunited. I might want to see, just because I think it might be kind of fun to see them live, I'd love to have U2 do a set. Let's see. The police, because Sting could be there as well, because I like his solo stuff too. Of course, I'm just jumping right back in time here on all of this. I think I might say some guys you don't know. There's an artist named BT. He's kind of a techno guy. He's very innovative. I would just love to be at a BT concert. Let's see. It's all just off the top of my head. I'm not Googling anything right now. Oh, 21 Pilots. They would definitely be there. They're great. My wife loves 21 Pilots, and she kind of turned me on to them. So they would absolutely have to be at the Shelton Dream Music Festival, because she'd kill me if they weren't there. Those are some of the ones I could think of. That'd be quite. Oh, ABBA, Fleetwood Mac. Oh my God, yes. Oh, Fleetwood Mac. How could I have not said that one? Yes. Oh, so Fleetwood Mac. Yeah, absolutely. Duran Duran, Queen, yes. Oh, you guys are, you're getting me. You are totally getting what I'm putting down, guys. Yes, we're nailing it. Yeah, this is Chris's Coachella. All right, George Smiley, what is a snapped terminal? Okay, this is another term in Scientology for if you basically become another person, right? It's the idea. It's kind of like you're so connected or tied into another personality, and you've done things to that person of an unkind nature that you become them. You snap terminals. You go from this position to this position, right? If you imagine two terminals interacting, that's how Hubbard connected or analogized communication and people as their terminals. And so here you have terminal A and terminal B, and they're communicating. But if terminal A starts doing things to terminal B, he pulls in motivators, right? They start going toward A. And this kind of magnetically draws A to B. A becomes obsessed with B because of the things that A has been doing to B, and therefore snaps terminals and becomes that person. That's the best explanation I have for it. It's a little weird. I know. Yeah. Okay. Oh, gosh, yes. Leslie Bishop asks, Chris, don't you think insurance has much to do with poor mental health resources and education? Absolutely, yes. Our insurance industry is practically criminal with what they get away with in not covering or giving funding to mental health resources. This is one of the reasons why mental health access is so bad in this country. Your insurance is tied to your job. If you don't have a job, or your job sucks, or the insurance package your job offers you, well, too bad. That's all you get. It's criminal. It's horrible. It's so bad here. Yeah. Yeah, no worries there, George, about that. I need to see them, Debbie. I'm sorry, I can't go back in the chat and pull that up. Can't put questions in the Q&A box on his phone. Should be able to do that, but if not, somebody else have to type them in there for me in the next minute or two, because we're gonna be wrapping up here in a second. I'm sorry if I missed anything important there, but you got to get them in there, or I can't see them. Everybody's still listing bands to be at my dream music festival. Oh my God, the Beatles. Boy, there's some good suggestions here, actually. Yeah. Yeah, the Beatles. Yeah. God, Dire Straits. Oh, you guys are naming all the good hits. Yes, exactly, Joe. Exactly right. Just as a comment there, the United States was definitely not founded as a Christian nation, just so we're all clear. I don't believe it was, right? I was answering earlier that there's a lot of people who think it was. Joe DiCeppo, didn't Tolkien write Lord of the Rings as a way of dealing with his PTSD from the First World War? I believe that that was a factor in his writings, but he was writing before and during the war. And yes, I believe that PTSD or some of that or some of his trauma or whatever was compelling him to write some of what he was writing. But I also know that he was doing it because he was making up stories for his kids. As bedtime stories. And that's how that, I believe that's the origin story of The Hobbit, which became the Lord of the Rings. If I have my Tolkien lore right, I think that's the way it went down. DM asks, if Christians who split from their religion would go to hell, what is the punishment for people who leave Scientology or ditch the Sea Org? Is there any eternal damnation? Yes. Apostate Alex is in the chat. Cool. You lose your eternity. You got to go up the bridge. That's the whole point. You don't lose your eternity just because you leave the Sea Org. But if you leave Scientology, you are giving up your eternity. You are keeping yourself in the prison of Earth, of the physical universe. And you're stuck here. You've been stuck here. This is your time. This is your window to get out. This is the only chance you're going to get. This is what Scientology has to say about it. So if you leave, you're going right back into the trap. That's the idea. Okay. here's a great last question. Second to last question, because I see Alex has asked me something, so I'll throw him in here too. Young Matador, according to The Hollywood Reporter, only 37% of viewers in the USA who started Rings of Power actually watched all 8 episodes to completion. I'm guessing you were one of those. You are guessing properly, correctly. Yes, that is true. And Apostate Alex asks, Chris, did you watch The Umbrella Academy? If so, what did you think? I watched the first season and half of Umbrella Academy and I turned it off. It was confusing to me and I didn't quite like where it went. I don't know how else to put it. I don't like the time travel weird stuff and interdimensional stuff. It seemed, I don't know, it just wasn't my thing. And I had a hard time connecting with any of the characters in a sympathetic way. I tried, I wanted to, but it was hard. It was just kind of weird, you know? I mean, that one guy off on the moon, he was a pretty sympathetic guy, that big guy. I could kind of connect with him, but, the other characters seemed unlikable and I'm speaking in general terms here, but I just, from what I remember, I understood. I could most identify in a way with the woman who could tell people what to do and command them, and then they could do it. And I don't identify with that because that's what I can do. I identify with it because of the mind control stuff, right? And the after effects of it, the negative consequences of it. I was like, oh, that's nailing it. That I thought was good. But it was such a dysfunctional family, right? I don't know why. This is a personal thing for me, above and beyond genre, beyond story. I just don't like watching dysfunctional families. I don't know what it is about that. Maybe my own past or whatever, but I just... And it doesn't mean that everybody has to be getting along and everything has to be wonderful and everything has to be fine. I don't mean I don't like conflict. Conflict drives any story. I like conflict, but dysfunction and the kind of abusive stuff that happens and the sort of like, you know, factioning and misunderstandings and the gross levels of anger and hostility that can generate and, you know, and all of that kind of stuff that happens in these family kind of things. I always just feel like, why can't you guys just talk? I'm always yelling at the screen. Why can't you talk? Why don't you guys ever communicate? What is the problem, right? Why can't you just say what's on your mind, you fucking people? Why do you have to do this? Why do you have to be this way? You know, it always drives me crazy. I get so into it. I don't know. It's where I'm at. Maybe I shouldn't let that, you know, get to me so much, but I just do. Just in terms of trying to figure out why it was I didn't like that show, I think that's what was preventing me from connecting to them, sort of talking my way through this here. I don't know. You know, there were parts I liked. There were definitely things that I liked. The thing that I also didn't connect with at all and confused the hell out of me was who the hell was that old man, that father figure guy who was doing all this stuff? Was he an alien? What was that all about? It annoyed me. I was very annoyed by that. Anyway, I'm only talking to people who've seen the show at this point, but yeah, that's what I got. Okay. Enough is enough. It's been an hour and a half. I didn't think we would go this long. I didn't think I'd get this many people on today. You guys are awesome. Thank you very much for coming around and watching me blabber on here about all this. I think that there are exciting things happening right now. I think that there are good things coming. I am very, very thankful for the support and for the fact that you guys think I have something valuable to contribute to all of this. So I want to again thank you for coming around. And yeah, let's wrap up. I will be recording my show with Tony probably in half an hour. and that's where we're going. Yeah. So I will say hi to my mom for you guys. This is actually, you know, I will say this. I am feeling a lot more comfortable on camera lately than I have in a long time. And I think that's a reflection of you guys and your positivity towards what I'm trying to do here, actually. So I really, really appreciate it. Again, I want to thank all of you out there who are supporting me through Patreon or PayPal or something. I would really like it if there could be more of you doing that. I don't sit here all day asking for super chats and donations and all that kind of stuff. I see that there's a lot of negativity around doing that, and I try not to go there. But I am going to just end today by saying that I really, really could use your support some more. You know, it is awesome to be able to do this work. And the only thing that allows me to keep doing it is the fact that I am fan funded by you guys. So if you would consider, signing up on Patreon or, you know, showing me some love otherwise, I would very, very much appreciate it. It'd be great. And on that, let's go ahead and end the show. Talk to you guys soon. Yeah. There it is. Bye-bye.